welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Baum.
With the new year looming, we'll be taking a moment to look back at the ghost of Weekly's past, revisiting some of the highlights of 2018.
We'll be re-listening to chats from the likes of legendary filmmaker Werner Herzog,
musician Roisin Murphy,
poet and novelist Ben Okri, and many more.
It's a bumper show ahead, so join us over the next hour as we take you through the year that was on the best of the Monocle Weekly, right here on Monocle 24.
So, Rob, here we are. How was your Christmas? You made a little time to join us on a special edition of the briefing on Christmas Day itself.
It wouldn't have been Christmas without that. It wouldn't have been a Christmas without a little iron in the Monocle 24 fire, right? Okay? You've always got to watch, though, how much you push your iron into the Monocle 24 fire.
You can get singed.
It's hot in there, isn't it?
It is an absolute furnace.
Not like Studio One today, though. We've kind of appropriated the outside temperature with the inside temperature here in Studio One. Our editor-in-chief would be proud. It is about 1 degree in here, would you have said?
Well, I would say Arctic. It's ballpark Arctic.
Ballpark Arctic. Yeah, we've got some kind of seasonal radio knitwear on, obviously, and we're looking forward to New Year. So let's tick off Christmas. Mine was lovely, quite countrified, familial and happy. What about yours, Tom?
I got a little bit countrified as well, so yeah. A bit of a sore head the next day. But no, I was down in Dorset.
You and John Craven.
Down in Dorset. Really lovely stuff. A country Christmas.
Yeah.
Log fires, the family gathered, a bit of wassailing went on. Wonderful, lovely stuff. But I often find, particularly in this sort of slightly curious hinterland betwixt and between Christmas and the New Year's festivities, which will be ramping up, tomorrow night, a time maybe for a little bit of reflection. And in a sense, that's what we're doing on the programme. We've raided the weekly archive. What a year it's been, Rob.
What a year it's been. Just a few of the names that you read out at the top of the show there. Looking forward to hearing from them again. Shall we crack on?
Let's get to it, Rob. Here's a chat with Roisin Murphy, who I had the pleasure of talking to alongside colleague Augustine Machlari back in October. She made her name, of course, with Moloko. But Roisin's gone on to cement her reputation, Rob, with release after banging release. Most recently, working with the legendary producer Maurice Fulton.
Okay, and in this next section, she explains how why working with Morris was rewarding, if not always easy, and why collaboration with Italo disco icon Giorgio Moroder was never meant to be.
These tracks that have been released over the summer, you've been doing with Maurice Fulton, who's a legend, kind of amazing producer, and that process.
Pain in the arse.
Really? Please expand.
I think that's probably the most difficult working relationship I've ever had, and he was totally, he's no problem with me telling people, but he really, you wouldn't work with Maurice Fulton to tell him what to do, you know, and if I tried to say, well, you know, can we do this, that, whatever, if he had played it in the club that weekend and it had worked, there was no touching the thing. And in fact, he told me that I could either take it or leave it a couple of times, literally, that he would delete everything if I just didn't shut up, you know. So he's really a strong character. And you don't work with Maurice for any other reason. And it's coming from straight from the gut with him, you know. It isn't intellectualised. It isn't sort of really thought out. It's like he knows innately what he's got to do. And that's what you hear in his music. So I accepted it in the end, but it didn't, for that reason, feel like an album, you know, like a Roisin Murphy album. I didn't feel I could slick it to that point or stamp it to that point. And so I decided to go with it as a club cultural object, you know, as a thing that was about, it either worked in the club and it worked or it didn't. And the 8 tracks that ended up coming out, which were less than what we did together, work in that environment in one way or another, or they relate to that environment authentically in one way or another. And so that was helpful in terms of what I did with the videos, in terms of what I did with the visual, in terms of the whole conversation around the work, you know. So that was why I put it as 4 pieces of vinyl or 4 releases. I mean, it's available digitally, but they're staggered. They're staggered releases, 2 tracks at a time. And they're, for the most part, you know, have done radio edits of things, but they're long tracks. They're for the club, you know, they're from that environment, and authentically so. And it helped me with the visual. It's really good when you're making visual for a big project like this to have an anchorage as well, you know, and that just really, I just took it as it. It's pretty obvious, but I took it as red, you know, and it helped me.
On that point, though, in terms of the creative process, I don't know, how different is your creative approach, I suppose, depending on where the songs are designed to be experienced? Like, is it different if you're musing on something and it becomes just a little, you know, it's a vocal note that you've got, or if it's something that's very directly for the club scene, it's for yes. it's dynamic, it's for dancing. What? How's your creative experience different?
In a way, and having said all that I've said, I did need somebody like Maurice to put the foot down as well, because I have a tendency to finesse and to, you know, and I think club music is interesting in that, you know, I mean, I met Giorgio Moroder to go to work with him. He wanted to do a track with me or something for his album a few years ago. And it never happened, because when he sent me the tracks, I was like, God, this is not like what I expected at all, you know. And I had conversations with him, and he couldn't stop talking about David Guetta. And it was really at the height of the David Guetta thing as well. And I was very surprised by this. And because to be honest with you, I consider what he did some of the greatest records ever made, you know, that still you put on a system still like beats the hell out of like brand new records, you know. It's unbelievable what he did. And plus also, she was incredible too, you know, Donna Summer. It's very underrated how amazing a singer and a songwriter she actually was. And all this emotion and this darkness tied up in it and all this. And I was saying all this to her, and it was kind of like I was talking to the wall, you know. And I just don't know, like, I'm not going to make a judgment. I don't know where his music came from. I do know that he worked in advertising in Italy, advertising music, before he kind of got struck onto the disco thing. And I do know that he more or less stopped when, you know, after they burnt all the disco records, and in America it just became a non-functional thing. It became a thing that just wasn't selling a lot of records anymore, you know. And there's a sort of bluntness and a kind of like it either works or it doesn't. That's one level, like it either works or it doesn't in the club, you know, that is almost removed from being a creative. It's more like a kind of artisan, you know, that you understand your craft, you do your craft, and you don't let any nonsense get in the way. And then there is this thing of like, obviously he seemed to me, well, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed to me that he was interested in things that were very successful, you know, as well, rather than something underground, brave, experimental, and all these things, you know. And that's where I'm coming from as an artist, you know. And it's a sort of keep it simple, stupid mentality, or, you know, it's a sort of like, what, you know, what's going to make people dance, like, you know. And then another situation is maybe how I work with Eddie Stevens, who I made last albums with, who's like my, you know, cosmic brother, you know. I've known him for 25 years. His beautiful story, how he came around after all these years of being my musical director and came around to being my producer and writer, and all these things. And he's a totally different kettle of fish. And it's then me that's sort of holding him back from overdoing it. So every single time I do work with a new collaborator, it's a new thing. I'm lucky that way, you know, because that means I can have a new era every time.
Rasheen Murphy there, speaking to Tom and Augustin Macellari back in October this year.
Rupert Everett's a familiar face from stage and screen, but his talent extends beyond acting. He's published a series of memoirs, and most recently written, directed and starred in the critically acclaimed Oscar Wilde biopic, The Happy Prince. Here he explains to Monocle's rather starstruck Ben Rylan that his determination to be a star arrived at an early age.
First of all, I decided I was Julie Andrews' daughter after I saw Mary Poppins. That went on for a bit, and then I stopped, and then when I started acting in the school plays, I built myself a dressing room on the fire escape, which had wig stands, makeup table, a mirror with bulbs around it, telegrams from famous people saying kind of good luck, darling, you're fantastic, two telephones which I'd pick up and kind of talk to agents in Italy and stuff like that. And actually, it was all pretty accurate, really. And people would come up to my dressing room, and obviously everyone else in the school thought I was insane. And then the master who's in charge of fire, health and safety, dismantled it because it was on a fire escape. So I was back with the rest of them.
Why did you want to be famous? Even back then, what did you think being famous was?
Just being very glamorous and knowing Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn. And it was much smaller, kind of much more humble, really, than today's idea of fame. Yeah, being in Hollywood and starring with Julie Andrews, that was really all I really thought about, being in a film with Julie Andrews.
So aside from Julie Andrews, who were the famous people that you were thinking of back then, who you were idolising? Who were the people that made you think, this is something I not only want, but could possibly have?
Well, Julie Andrews, really.
Just Julie?
Well, at first, I know, it probably sounds a bit tragic, but yeah, at first really just Julie. Then a little bit later, at about the age of 14, when I went to a bigger school, we started seeing other things. And I then saw Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. And that kind of really did turn my head too, partly because I loved the way it looked. In the old days in England, every Saturday and Sunday, there were old movies. Then I discovered Bette Davis, aged about 14 and a half, just as puberty was coming on. And that was very life-changing, her in All This in Heaven 2, or her in Stolen Life, her in Dark Victory, all these things. I was just amazed by her. I went to London. I discovered things like the 50s, 1950s. James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, A Place in the Sun. And that really was very head-turning too. And then I'd read about Montgomery Clift. And then my trajectory changed somewhat, because at first I wanted to be much more spit-spot, like Julie Andrews, and very conventional. But once I'd read about Montgomery Clift always having drinks full of mandrax and quaaludes and being off his face and having car crashes and being cradled by Elizabeth Taylor, I thought I wanted that. Endless, you know, suffering. I wanted to suffer, and be very tortured and not say anything and just, you know, be very, generally very mysterious. So that's what I tried to do next.
There is something about the idolization of the tragedy and the suffering that goes into that. Does that play a part in what you would consider as the glamour of celebrity? There's this idea that there has to be something a little bit murky, a little bit tragic underneath it.
When we were kids, the whole thing was so different, and we worshipped suffering and smoking and having a hard time. All those stars like Marlon Brando, James Dean, Montgomery Clift, I Could Have Been a Contender. It was all about the glamorization of not managing to pull things off, and suffering and being all wound up inside. And so I think that wasn't particularly unique to me. We worshipped that kind of black and white, silver screen sadness and madness, and Vivian Lee was going off the rails, and we'd rejected kind of conventional theatre and conventional cinema. There were amazing films like A Taste of Honey and If and all those things in the UK. By the time I got to drama school, I wanted to be kind of a weird, freaky, beatnik, junky kind of character.
And what did you become? Or at least, how did you go about creating what you would eventually become?
I literally spent 1 year not wearing shoes. And I don't know how I managed to pull that off, because I'm so kind of foot phobic and sidewalk phobic now. I don't know, but I never wore shoes. I went out everywhere bare feet. I got into bed without washing those bare feet off the street. I kind of got very into going out in the 70s, it was a wonderful time in London in the 70s, really, because the gay scene was really quite different from now. It was very small. It was very classless for such a class-structured country. Because it was so small, everyone from any old area came to the same place. And you counted just for daring to go, in a way. I loved all that. I loved the outsiderishness of being gay, because even though we were just legalized 7 years before, it was still a very much an outside world. And one looked at the real world as the enemy, almost. And that's quite luxurious. It's quite a fun perspective. And it was a time of punk, too. That was very exciting and verging on dangerous. You know, there was always the King's Road was always verging on being on in a riot. Everything closed down on a Sunday, completely closed down, the whole of London. But it was a very exciting time. There were gay skinheads, tons of leather queens and cowboys and Indians and weird freaks everywhere.
That was Rupert Everett talking to Monocle's Ben Rylan. Now, here at The Weekly, we've been lucky enough to interview a number of pretty incredible filmmakers this year, and we'll be hearing from one of those later in the show. But let's kick off with Eugene Jarecki, documentarian and maker of this year's absolutely phenomenal Elvis road trip odyssey, The King.
In his film, Jarecki uses Elvis Presley's extraordinary career to explore the changing fortunes and values of the United States itself. Here, he explains to Tom and Fernando Augusto Pacheco how he arrived at his novel approach and how the election of the most controversial president in U.S. history gave his film an unexpected urgency.
Well, when we began, I mean, I had seen that there was a metaphoric power in looking at Elvis Presley and the country he left behind. And so we started out to make a poetic look at the sort of metaphor of Elvis, which inevitably has a demise at the end of it. But it rises beautifully and majestically, as America did. And it sort of then plateaus and finds itself tangled in unexpected power. You know, Elvis suddenly had the world in his hand when he was just virtually an adolescent. And what's more American than that, really? That's the story of the country. And then from there, it's a slippery slope into all that self-medication and the sort of effort to cure those ills that he had inherited. And America has had so much of that. So there was always a poetic and rather melancholy underpinning to it all. But we started making this film before the contemporary crisis that America is now gripped in. You know, that man who occupies the Oval Office, he was just a nuisance to New Yorkers at that time and a failed kind of real estate person who had a reality show. He wasn't the threat to humanity that he's become. So we, in an accidental way, kind of predicted that by setting out to cross the country, and we'll talk about how, but to cross the country and really take stock of things, how they got to that point where then that was possible, that he then ran for office and that it went the way that it did, suggested that a lot of our concerns about America, the things that we were most poignantly focused on, suddenly were coming to pass, as if the end of the story was being written while we were still just trying to catch up with it. I hadn't expected that kind of a demise to suddenly be thrust upon us. I was making a love letter, and a love letter like Tough Love that says, hey, I love you, America, but you need therapy. You are crazy on power and money. This is getting out of control. And then in walks the human embodiment of how catastrophic power and money can be in a democracy.
And Eugene, it's interesting you said Tough Love, because, you know, of course, the film, in a way, usually documentaries like this, they are love letters, you know, to the artist. But there's quite a lot of criticism against the artist itself, you know, the way they mimic, you know, the black sound at the time. There's been some talk about cultural appropriation. So was that your intentions, or to give voice as well for people, not only saying, oh, Elvis was a megastar, he's the king and and everything?
Well, can you imagine anything more boring than hearing a bunch of people talk over and over in a puff piece about a celebrity? We've had enough of that as a civilization. So for me, I'm only ever interested in textured subjects. And if I do find love, I have deep love of Elvis Presley, but my love of Elvis Presley is the kind of love I would want someone to have for me. The people who tell you that everything you do is right and nothing you do is wrong, those people killed Elvis. So if you want to save Elvis, if you want to step into history and in some sort of reach back in time and intervene, you've got to be willing to tell him, where is this leading? This is not a road to anywhere. This power and money is destroying that which made you beautiful and enduring for the time that it did. It'll undo you. And I want to do that toward Elvis in retrospect, but I was trying to do it in contemporary America. I wanted to intervene between America and the power and the money that is destroying her.
Eugene, let me ask you a bit about one of the vehicles, and it's a slightly clunky pun from me, that you used to undertake this journey, which is, of course, this 63 Rolls-Royce, which is an amazing thing. Very different, the dynamics of your subjects as they get in and out. Some people are literally sort of moved to tears, others find it really interesting. As the sort of journey, literal and metaphorical, continued, did that tell you anything about the nature of what it is to, I guess, be American, the pursuit? You know, there's this interesting point in there about the pursuit of happiness, but, you know, the only country where that pursuit is enshrined, if you like. Is it a sort of an empty promise? Does it suggest that these peaks and troughs we have are cyclical? I don't know. As you went on that journey, did your expectation, were they fulfilled?
That's central to the poetry of Elvis Presley. Because, look, Elvis Presley is the embodiment for so many people of the American dream. But there's a contradiction in it because, yeah, he comes out of nowhere and he can rise to unimaginable heights. But the American dream wasn't for everybody. That could happen for him because he was a white guy. It wouldn't have happened for a woman. It wouldn't have happened for black people. It didn't happen for so many people. So first of all, there's a contradiction in him embodying the American dream because the American dream is itself contradictory. Then comes the Rolls-Royce itself. The Rolls-Royce as a vehicle was not an accidental vehicle for us. It's not like, you know, oh, why didn't you... David Simon, the creator of The Wire, is in the film, and he says to me, he's a super smart guy, and he says, why didn't you take one of his Cadillacs or a Thunderbird or, you know, convertible old Detroit car? Well, for a very specific reason, those are American dream machines. They drink the Kool-Aid. You watch those cars enough with their candy colored and their chrome and the sky is blue and it goes on forever and it's mom and pop at the white picket fence. That's a dream that America has promoted to the world, but it's not the actuality for Americans. What's actual is to drive an Elvis Presley's 1963 Rolls-Royce and realize the unbelievable mind the gap, to put it in British terms, that class gap issue that is so dominant in the country. Elvis became a king, and that is contradictory to the values of a democracy. A democracy, a republic like America, is not supposed to become an empire ruled by an oligarchy, and a country boy is not supposed to become a king. We're supposed to love country boys. Look, he can get a little famous, he can get some money, but he's supposed to love his mom, which he did. He's supposed to still barbecue in the backyard, which kind of stopped doing because Graceland's a bit of a castle and because it all got very rarefied. So to have this king, this boy king, lost in the big back seat of this gilded cage, that was the poetry of driving that Rolls-Royce across America for Elvis. For America, we drove that car into places like the south side of Memphis and the poor parts of Tupelo, Mississippi, and things like this, where people would come out and they would look at it like it had landed from another planet. Mm. The socioeconomics are such that they've never even seen a car like that. And isn't that symbolic of that true story of the American dream?
Eugene Jarecki there speaking to Fernando and Tom in August 2018. We'll be revisiting a chat with acclaimed war photographer Lindsay Addario after this. From a chronicler of one nation's struggles to someone that's captured the rest of the world's now, as we head from much-lauded conflict photojournalist Lindsay Addario.
Lindsay joined us last month on the occasion of the launch of her first photo book of love and war. As the title suggests, the book collects the haunting, beautiful, and indeed hauntingly beautiful images of people at the extremes of experience taken by Addario over her two-decade career. Here she explains to me and Augustine how navigating the tension between love and war, violence and beauty lies at the very heart of her interest as a photographer.
For me as a photojournalist covering these really devastating, difficult moments around the world, often in war, at the height of war, sometimes in the aftermath, I'm always trying to figure out how do I bring in the viewer? How do I make someone engage with a photograph and really enter it? And that is difficult to do when the photo is graphic or bloody or too violent, because I think most people's instinct is to turn away. So for me, it's really about how can I capture that devastation in a more subtle way, or sometimes in a beautiful way, because people can stop and look at an image and then realize what's actually happening.
This is something I wanted to ask about, because obviously we're now entering this sort of much touted age of the citizen journalist, and the image has also undergone this often spoken about democratization. People are sharing videos and images from terrible places on Twitter. It's very easy to find this sort of thing. How does that not compromise what you're setting out to do?
Well, actually, I think it makes my work all the more important because, first of all, people on social media have to realize and be very aware of where they get their news sources and where they are looking at the images from, because you need to trust that the photographer or journalist or whoever is behind the lens is not biased, that you're actually, the caption is correct, the information underneath the photograph, you know, what photographers call the caption, but really the information that accompanies the photograph is accurate, because falsehoods spread like wildfire on social media. And so it's very important for people to understand where the images are coming from. We also are inundated with images all the time. And so I've always believed sort of the best images will rise to the top, that professional photographers know how to take that image, or we strive to take that image that encapsulates not only information, but beautiful light and composition and all the things that do get people to pay attention.
Do you find that you're having to justify your credentials in a different way with a certain audience who say, well, hang on, how do I know, Lindsay, that you're portraying the truth of the situation to me?
Ironically, it has nothing to do with social media. It has everything to do with the political climate in which we're living. You know, I think I am an American journalist. I've spent most of my career working for The New York Times and National Geographic and Time, and those are all publications that are very reputable. There is very extensive fact-checking that goes on. So when I shoot a story, for example, for National Geographic, they spend weeks fact-checking every single image and contacting the people in the photographs. And so it's not fake news. But we do live in a climate now where we have a president who says very often that journalists are the enemy of the people. He does use the term fake news a lot. He does get the attention of his supporters. And so that is a big problem for journalists, not only in America, but around the world, because people are skeptical now of journalists in a way they weren't so much before. We also are in a climate where journalists are targeted more than before around the world. We look at the killing of Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist. That is astonishing that it, you know, there hasn't been full-on condemnation by the American government yet. Because I think the fact is, with the rhetoric that journalists are the enemy of the people, it does give governments license to think that they can kill journalists with impunity. For me, when I started covering, for example, the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan or the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, I was proud to be a journalist and an American journalist, and we drove around with the words TV on our cars and put journalist on our flak jackets. And that's something that we would never, ever do now, because journalists are getting kidnapped. Of course, they're getting killed. They're disappearing. You know, prominent journalists, too. I mean, it's not just sort of not that it makes a difference, because any journalist is a journalist doing a service, but it's pretty unbelievable when very high-profile journalists suddenly go missing or are killed, and it's not condemned worldwide.
Lindsay Addario there, discussing her book of Love and War back in November.
Now, the Icelandic conceptual artist Ragnar Kjartansson made waves in the UK with his solo show at the Barbican back in 2016. This autumn, he returned to London with one of his most iconic works, A Lot of Sorrow. In it, rock band The National play their hit, Sorrow, over and over and over and over for 6 hours. Ragnar caught up with Monocle's Holly Fisher to explain why it's actually a joyful work and how he convinced the band to do it.
You know, I just wrote them an email and asked them if they thought this was a, if they were up to do this, and they just said, yes, we are. It was, the main question was like, if Brian the drummer could do it, it's because it's totally insane to drum this for 6 hours, but he heroically did it.
What was it about that particular song that made you want them to perform that?
No, it's just sort of the idea about kind of turning a song into a sculpture painting. And suddenly I was just doing the dishes, listening to A Lot of Sorrow for probably the 800th time, when I just realized, like, this is a song I need to make a piece about, because it is just so gorgeous. It's like, it's one of the most gorgeous songs I've heard, because it's just like rhythmically and the melody and just the mood in it. And of course the gorgeous lyrics, which are so beautifully kind of depictive of melancholia and sadness in a sort of a joyful way.
Oh,
I mean, the piece is called A Lot of Sorrow because the song is called Sorrow. But it's actually quite a joyful piece of art that you've made, but that's mostly due to the relationship between the band and the audience. You know, you've got this man singing about really sad things over and over again for 6 hours, but the audience have really got his back and they want him to carry on and get to the end of it and play it again. And I love the ending when they ask for an encore. And were you expecting to end up with such a joyful piece of video art at the end of making this?
No, I was not. No, because it's always like, I didn't know what to expect, but I was curious. This piece ended up with being something, something really warm. Mm. In all this kind of, because then also in the aesthetics, I wanted it to be really cold. You see, like the stage is just like white and there's just smoke. So it's sort of, I always thought that this should be like a Gerhard Richter painting, like a cold German painting. But then like, the emotional substance is so warm, which I'm really happy about. And of course, that's also how they are as a band. They're a very generous band, I would say.
I mean, you've done a few different pieces of work that have been people performing the same song over and over again. But the thing about this particular piece that makes it different is that the people performing it are the people who made it.
Yeah.
How did that make this a different piece from, say, The Sky in a Room or the piece you did with the Mozart piece?
I mean, it's very different to have the songwriters themselves perform it. I mean, I have other instances where because it's sort of a form I've been working with like where you make a song sculptural or painterly. Yeah, there's something quite gorgeous about the performer doing it. But in other instances, I wouldn't want the performer to do it. So it's, every piece kind of calls for existence. Like, you know, like El Cielo in una Stanza was about that space and people from Wales who were kind of new to the song, about doing the song, but not like having a...
Yeah, that was very reflective of the room it was in and the instrument it was being played on. And I mean, this is a sort of site-specific place you did in a museum in Wales.
You know, different from having Gino Paoli perform it. You know, that's like when there's the star performing it, something completely different happens. Then it's, in a way, stops being the song and becomes the performer of the song. But that is also interesting about the National, because they have this quality of nobody. I mean, they're really big stadium-filling rock stars, but they're not like stars. They just are the song. And even like in the way they dress and all this stuff, it's just like, I am performing this song. And it's really not like a... Because my godmother was a singer, she would always dress in black and say like, a singer should never come in between the song and the audience. And weirdly, like, the National have that quality.
Yeah, even on a big stage, they're quite an intimate band.
That was Ragnar Kjartansson and Monocle's Holly Fisher in conversation this past autumn.
Next up, Jim Broadbent, who spoke to Monocle's Augustin Macellari back in the summer, best known for his Oscar-winning performances in films ranging from some of the Harry Potter films to the Iris Murdoch biopic Iris. Jim joined us to discuss a rather more personal project, the release of his graphic novel Dull Margaret.
Illustrated by British cartoonist Dix, who Jim first spotted in the back pages of The Guardian, Dull Margaret tells the dark story of a lonely woman eking a living from the cold and unforgiving Lincolnshire coastline. Here he explains how living along that same coastline first fired his imagination.
It was quite a while back, so I'm not entirely sure. I think it came sort of from a number of different things at the same time, really. I come from Lincolnshire, and we had a place very near the coast at the time, and I spent a lot of time on the Lincolnshire coast, and it's very flat and parts of it are very marshy and wet and muddy. That always intrigued me, and it was always empty. There were very few people there. And I also started getting into the whole idea of fairy stories, and I started thinking of wanting to write a film script. And the idea of writing a film script always comes from writing a good part for myself, really. And I had the idea of this sort of lonely woman living out on the marshes, lives by catching eels. So I started researching eel catching and her being lonely. And I quite fancied the idea of playing her, because she was obviously going to be a rather plain woman. So it all came up together, really, in the fairy stories. And then I thought, well, she could have witchy skills, and you know, spells and incantations and sort of witchy salves and ointments, and she could put together. So that all combined together, really. And so I wrote this film script, which is basically a one-woman show.
I did wonder about that, because there's very little dialogue. So it's more, I mean, I suppose it's all stage direction.
Well, it is. It's all. It's nearly all stage direction, isn't it? So, which is ideal for sending it to an artist when I want to make it into a graphic novel, because it's all description and, as you say, very little dialogue, which is probably, from Dix's point of view, he's the artist, was a blessing. So he hasn't got to have huge speech bubbles.
That's it, more room for him to kind of flex his pen. I'd like to ask a bit more about Dix in a sec, but I also read that the kind of figure of Margaret herself was in part inspired by a Bruegel painting.
There's certainly the name, Dull Margaret, and it comes from De la Greet, the Bruegel painting of De la Greet at the gates of hell. It's this strong, very sort of striking, ugly, funny woman, heavily clad in sort of a mishmash of clothes and bearing odd weapons and marching across the gates of hell. And it's a very striking image, and I just like that strength in her. And there's a humour in her as well, somehow.
I completely agree. I looked at it, and she looks incredibly purposeful. Mm. She's kind of, as you say, tooled up and ready to take on the hordes. Margaret, in your book, there's a lot more pathos to her.
Yeah, I think there's... I love the name, De la Greet, and then that translates as Mad Meg. But I like the dull bit of her from my perspective. I like her being dull and rather plain and in the plain and very bland marsh world that she lives in. It all sort of fitted in. But so it's not really drawn from the painting too much, but there's a spirit of Margaret that I drew from Greet, I suppose.
I'm interested by your sort of relationship with the Lincolnshire coast. The coasts on the north of England, I've read some really great literature that kind of ruminates on them in this very folkloric way. I don't know if you've read The Loney, which came out a couple of years ago.
No, I don't know that. No.
I'm from the east, so I know about the fens rather than... Yeah. Which is also a place where people catch eels, actually. So The Loney is set on this stretch of land and also centres around this kind of very arcane, almost atavistic ritual that's never really brought into the foreground quite in the way that Dull Margaret's is. How connected are you to folklore, and how familiar are you with kind of witchy traditions and practices?
Well, no, I read a lot. I've got lots of books and histories and different, you know, and the witch hunts and in Europe and also I took a lot from sort of Bruegel etchings and various medieval depictions of witches. But I wasn't familiar with the world at all before. But in researching, I went into a lot of it and found out quite a lot.
What's amazing about Margaret is that she seems less like someone who is actively a witch and more like someone who has this knowledge and is driven to use it by the kind of cruelty of her circumstances.
Yes, it's not her primary purpose being a witch, but she went in when she was, you know, driven to the depths of despair. She somehow remembered when the hanged man floats into her world that triggers a memory that she has those skills, that members.
Sort of ancestral almost.
Yeah.
There are moments of humour which, again, well, I read that your interest in working with Dix stemmed from a kind of shared dark humour, gallows humour. But Margaret is kind of presented as caught between these appalling feelings, which are profound loneliness and deep greed. And I suppose I wanted to ask whether you feel that one is a product of the other, which came first, and also just how you empathised with her when you were writing the script.
I adored her, really. I totally empathised with her. I mean, it's not so much greed as poverty. I mean, it's loneliness and poverty. Those are the two things. And she's, at the beginning, she's just about getting by, and then it all collapses and she's robbed and abused, and that's when it all comes to the fore. Now, I don't see her as greedy, I think, and just sort of... But she's quite childlike when the old man comes into her life, and she's a bully, but in a childish way, in the way that a child can bully a puppy because they can. No, she's got someone she can abuse and control. Mm. But it's not really her way, as it transpires. You know, that isn't a relationship that sustains its nature.
Jim Broadbent there, speaking to Augustin Macellari back in June. Do stay with us. In a moment, we'll be hearing from a talented pack of creators discussing the importance, Rob, of short stories. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Now, from graphic literature to another sometimes marginalised literary form, the short story. July saw the release of Pindrop Studios' short story collection, A Short Affair, which paired off writers and artists in a rather successful effort to unite the two sometimes disparate disciplines.
Tom and I were joined by the collection's editor, Simon Oldfield, as well as contributing artist Jesse Jetpacks and the author Ben Oakrey. The wide-ranging conversation is well worth revisiting online. But for now, enjoy this little extract as Ben explains the attraction of uniting literature and fine art and sets me straight on the preconceptions about the short story form.
Well, my last book is a book called The Magic Lamp, and it's a collaboration between myself and Rosemary Clooney, the artist, and 25 stories, 25 paintings. And it's very simple. It happened the other way around in this particular case. The paintings came first, and I responded, went into the paintings. But the reason why the intersection is so fascinating is because you're dealing with different worlds that actually come from the same depth of the human spirit, but they're different responses to the richness and the mystery of life. You could have nothing more polar opposites in many ways than a painting or a piece of installation and a piece of text. They massage different parts of the brain. With a piece of visual art, you actually see it, not completely, almost never completely if it's a great piece of painting or a great piece of art, but you have to see it repeatedly with the eyes or with other senses. With a piece of reading, with a piece of text, you have to imagine it. It creates the image in your mind, as it were. To bring these two spheres together is an act of magic, maybe even sometimes an act of alchemy.
That's pretty well said. So, Jesse, this is an interesting one for you because you've done a line drawing to illustrate the story that you've been paired with. This is not like your regular work. Some people kind of think that the short story is a bit of a palate cleanser for longer fiction. Is your line drawing, does it kind of help to recalibrate the rest of your work? Is it a sort of a nice exercise?
I think the problem with my work is I don't really have one kind of way of working. I really do make like a unrecognisable variety of things. And when I draw, I do tend to use line and quite graphical, flat images. I'm not really very whimsical with a paintbrush, and I like to involve, you know, Photoshop a lot, although I didn't with this one. It's kind of hard to articulate how that would tie in aesthetically with the rest of my practice, but I suppose the approach to what went in the image and how the image was rendered would be similar to the rest of my practice, in that it's an ongoing investigation and reinvestigation into how feelings relate to actions that you then have to complete.
I want to ask you about the tie-up between when you get the brief, as it were, when you read the story for the first time and react to it. But I want Ben to have a go at me about describing the short story as a palate cleanser for the longer form of literature. I'm sorry.
The short story is a good, strong drink
on
its own, onto itself. It's a world of its own. The short story is the extraordinary enigma of actually evoking a universe, a world, few pages. Anyone who treats the short story as a palate cleanser is going to lose at the World Cup.
Thanks.
He went straight there.
Yeah, didn't he? Yeah.
Well, when you knock the short story, we come out fighting, don't we?
I'm actually limping off with a groin strain here.
Yeah, in every interview that I've ever done with any of the authors, whenever that question sort of comes up from the audience as well, there's this immediate reaction. Yeah, it's like very prickly to it.
The hackles are raised.
Yes, exactly.
And Ben, your story, it's got a painterly-like quality to it. And I wondered whether actually you were riffing off a painting. It was such a visual story. It's called The Lighting of the Lamp, by the way. And it's so kind of rich in texture and things. It seems like quite a painterly thing. Have I got that wrong as well?
No. You got that absolutely right. Yeah, you got that right in a way that you would not guess. If it is painterly, it's because I am and was a frustrated painter. One of the first things I wanted to be was a painter, a composer. All of the things I failed at, writing came about 20th down the list. It just tells you, just keep on going down that list. You'll find something. No. Yeah, I'm very, very... Your instinct is absolutely right. I'm interested in the textuality of the world. And it's where poetry meets painting, in a way, the way in which image is distilled, the way in which you're always looking for the one thing to stand for the many things. It's the short story, it's the sonnet, it's the poem, it's the painting. It's We're keen on images. We're keen on one thing that multiplies many things. You really nailed a secret frustration that leaks into and informs a lot of my writing.
I like your idea of the short story as a strong drink. It's a martini or it's a Tom Collins or something. It's something that kind of hits you between the eyes, yes. Right? That's something that it should do.
And you're left reeling 2 days afterwards.
Yes, it lingers. I think that's also the point as well. And that's what's the most powerful, most successful short stories have that quality, most definitely.
Ben Oakery, Simon Oldfield and Jesse Jetpacks there, speaking to Tom and I back in July.
It's no overstatement to say that in the 21st century, electronic music rules the waves, with young artists speaking to audiences around the world, a newfound appreciation for some of the pioneers has emerged. Among them is Suzanne Ciani, whose work with the Buchler, a special synthesizer invented by her friend, paved the way for a generation of musicians and composers. Here she explains to Monocle's Augustin Macellari how an enduring love of the sea has shaped her work.
The sea. Well, the waves figure a lot in my life. And in fact, the documentary that just came out is called A Life in Waves. And I guess it's no accident that I'm living near the ocean now. But waves to me were many things. At first, represented a safe and calm place, the ocean, that mysterious, deep place that wasn't going to be ruined by human contact. Of course, all that's changed now because we polluted the ocean so terribly. It was also the compositional shape of my pieces. So my first album, Seven Waves, the form of each piece was the shape of a wave. So the pieces started out very calmly and low and built to a climax and then receded. The rhythm also came from the waves because I used a very slow tempo. I thought of it as something very feminine, as opposed to a masculine paradigm. And I think that that did represent a feminine energy, the ocean waves. I did neoclassical music. I have classical roots. And I spent 10 years concentrating on the Buchla in the 60s and 70s. And now I've come back to the Buchla. So I wouldn't say that's my, you know, I still use the waves when I start my Buchla concert. My starting point is always the ocean waves. And on Seven Waves, those waves were designed in the Buchla as well.
It's interesting that you were using the ocean as this kind of source of imagined peace and solitude from the context of this bustling metropolis of New York City. How did you square that desire for peace against your life at the time?
Well, I think possibly all that energy and intensity of New York inspired my need to find that peacefulness. And I first discovered it on a vacation to the Caribbean. So I went to a small island called St. Bart's, San Bartolomé, and that was my love affair with the warm, beautiful, sensual ocean that was there. I'm from the East, so I grew up outside of Boston. And the ocean was not maybe the most romantic place, but it was always a spiritual safety zone. My first album was born out of that need to find calmness. My music now is not necessarily calm, because now that I'm back with the Buchla and performing live, my main motivation now is to show what we could do in the 60s and 70s with on-the-spot, live, no pre-recorded sound, to be in the moment, creating the sound in the machine.
Monocle's Augustin Macellari in conversation with legendary synth composer Suzanne Ciani.
Finally today, a look back into the dim and distant past, February 2018, when we were lucky enough to get some time with one of the most important figures in modern cinema, Werner Herzog.
Monocle's correspondent Ziana Zulkifli caught up with the auteur at the Hong Kong International Film Festival, where he explained to her how his long career has imbued him with a singular clarity of vision and why he thinks film schools are a bit of a swizz.
I would not start a feature film, for example, without having seen it already, like in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. I see an entire film in front of me, and I hear the dialogues, and I see the locations, and because of that, it's very easy for me to write a screenplay.
So let's go back a little bit to the beginning. So I've heard that you fell into this purpose for film after finding a 15-page entry, encyclopedia entry on filmmaking. Is that true?
No, it's a myth in the media or on the internet. It was clear I would be a filmmaker, and I knew I would never go to film school. At that time, hardly any existed, but it was obvious that was not what I wanted to do. And I learned a few basics from some sort of an encyclopedia. I learned about the basic functioning of a celluloid camera, how it mechanically worked, how, for example, you could create slow motion. If you understand the mechanics of a camera, you would understand and can figure out how to create slow motion, for example. And some basic things, what was an optical soundtrack and what was possible in a laboratory, color gradings and things like this, very condensed, some 12, 15 pages maybe, and I went through it in a few days. And that's basically all you need to make films. It's a disgrace to spend 4 years in film school. You can do it in a week and then you are qualified to make a film.
You seem very curious about everything around you, even just this morning when I've met you. So you obviously pick up new things as you go along, and you are always experimenting. How has your films changed from that first short that you did to the latest film?
I think I do not need to give the answer. If you look at my early films and what I'm doing today and what I did 20, 25 years ago. Of course, I've never stood still. However, you still will see the films have a common life, a common culture, a common worldview. You would immediately, if you saw a film and you saw the first 2 minutes of it, you could, and you hadn't seen the credits, you would know that must have been my film. You could tell.
Yeah.
And how exactly to explain that, I don't know, but I only know I have changed and moved and never stood still, but the very basic vision, the very basic worldview, in a way unchanged.
And you also take a lot of risks for your work as a film director in terms of being in a dangerous place, for example, or setting impossible tasks like getting a ship up a mountain. How do you get your crew to get with it, like get with the program?
Well, I have never set myself impossible tasks. I think every grown-up man should move a ship over the mountain at least once in his or her life, if you're a young woman. Never impossible tasks, always things that were ultimately doable, but with a high amount of courage. And of course, when you have a very clear vision and when you have a great story, you will find people who would be undeterred and follow you and come along. You find the comrades. If you have a wonderful project, the people who will be on your side will be found. They come, they arrive.
And you're here for the Hong Kong International Film Festival. I'm very curious to know who you admire in the scene here in Asia.
Well, there's quite a few of them. What comes to mind right now is not so much Chinese. Instantly, I thought, for example, of the Apu trilogy made in the late 50s, or Kurosawa, Japanese, and of course some of the great Chinese filmmakers, Zhang Jimou, or Chen Kaige, and others. So there's always extraordinary films coming out from this region.
So tell me, what are you working on right now?
I'm in the middle of doing a film on Mikhail Gorbachev. I filmed with him twice at the end of last year, and he wants me back. He seems to like me, but he's quite old. He's 87 now. Yeah. His health is not very good, so I was supposed to be in Moscow filming with him 2 weeks ago, but he was, at that time, he was in hospital, and he said, no, don't come. But now he has summoned me in a little more than 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, I will be back in Moscow filming with him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I will be, then once I have all this done, I have to go into archival footage. So that's a longer procedure, and editing will take some time, but I want to finish it as soon as possible.
Cinematic legend Werner Herzog there, talking to Monocle's Zyana Zoghfly back in February of 2018. Well, Rob, there you have it. That's your Monocle Weekly. What a phenomenal, I don't know how to describe it, bonanza of a bumper look back on the last 12 months.
It was something like a phenomenon, wasn't it? I think the winds are set fair for a fairly decent 2019 in terms of interviews, in terms of our own. Are we rolling into 2019? I feel like we are. All guns blazing.
I don't know. I feel like I'm striding into it.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Confidently.
Yeah? What are you wearing? Sort of
face set against the...
With a leather short, plump of fetlock, yep. Firm of thigh.
Trousers full of leg.
Yeah, exactly. Like Elvis himself.
Quite.
The late Elvis thigh. Almost like a sort of architectural feature.
Legendary.
Without further ado, then, that is it for edition 495 and for 2018 here on the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Augustin Machellari, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Happy New Year.